Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, it was just yesterday we were wondering if we'd get to split the $20 million salary over at the Fox News Channel for the 9 o'clock slot. Apparently not going to happen. Tucker Carlson's been moved to 9 o'clock. Good for him. He's had very good ratings since taking over the 7 o'clock slot. But he's also featured here in our first good martini, or only good martini for the day. He was speaking with Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. They were talking about the sanctions that President Obama imposed on Russia. Cotton actually thought that should have happened a long time ago due to Russian aggression in a number of different ways that President Obama simply refused to respond to, including Ukraine and other areas over the past 8 years. But then Carlson wanted to know whether the sanctions were a good idea, given the fact that we are apparently allies with the Russians when it comes to stopping radical Islam. And Cotton was having none of it.
Aren't we basically on the same side as the Russians on the question of Islamic terror? It doesn't mean ignoring or excusing their awful behavior, but doesn't that outweigh that behavior?
Well, Tucker, I wish it were so, but if you look at what Russia has done in Syria, they've taken the fight hardly at all to the Islamic State. They fought almost entirely the Syrian opposition that was fighting against Bashar al-Assad. They haven't been bombing Raqqa, the capital of the Islamic State. They've been bombing Aleppo, which is the main opposition, was the main opposition holdout until it fell last month. It would be a good thing if Russia would work with the rest of the civilized world to counteract the threat of Islamic extremism, because they have their own Islamic extremists in the Caucasus region.
Yeah.
But they simply are not doing that in Syria. They're not doing much of it around the world either.
Excellent point that Cotton makes there, Jim, because Russia had ample opportunity to make some pretty devastating impacts against ISIS, didn't take it. And so the allegation that they're really on our side in this fight is pretty flimsy.
And we should point out, go back a little bit further, Greg, that did they help us in our efforts in Afghanistan against Al-Qaeda and against the Taliban? Yeah, they let us use, flyover rights and use a couple bases of their reasonably allied bases in the stand, countries in the stands and places like that. But all in all, it's not like they said, hey, we're going to stand with you shoulder to shoulder and we're going to hit the Taliban, too. They were not a help in Iraq. They've not been a help against any of our continuing operations since then. Yes, indeed, they are fighting an Islamist insurgency and forces like that in Chechnya. Their tactics tend to be a little more heavy-handed than I think we are comfortable with in terms of civilian casualties and things like that. I think Cotton hits it just the right note here, which is that, yeah, at first glance, it may look like Russia and we have a similar enemies. It would be nice if they would give us full-fledged help against ISIS and Al-Qaeda and related groups like that. So far, history does not point to that. And so there may be opportunities here and there. Certainly, we don't want to see Chechens and violent groups like that on the prowl. We are no stranger to their victims of their violence. You think back to the Boston Marathon bombing. But all in all, you're looking whether it's Syria or other places, Russia hasn't really been that big a help against us. And I think it's safe to say that for whatever reason, Al-Qaeda and other Islamist groups have seen us as the great Satan, not as not Russia for some reason. Chechnya, obviously, for reasons of geography and historical purposes, is much more likely to be anti-Russia than some Islamist groups are. ISIS has targeted Russia in some cases, particularly after the intervention in Syria. But Russia's attitude towards Syria is they want to keep Bashar Assad running the show so they get access to the port at Tartus and various other strategic interests. So I'm not so sure. Now, I don't know if this is Tucker Carlson kind of being a devil's advocate, but I think that Tom Cotton puts it just right. We should not demonize Russia in the way that certain Democrats have because of their the convenient scapegoat of using them as a reason for why Hillary Clinton lost the election. But I don't think it does us any good to see them as any better than they are. And that means that they're probably not going to be all that useful as an ally in the war on terror, the war on ISIS, the war on Islamic extremism. And good for Cotton for pointing that out. And hopefully that will be the dominant thinking in the years to come, instead of this way too generous assessment that we tend to hear from Donald Trump too often.
Yeah, absolutely right. And of course, the Russians played a key role in Iran's construction of their nuclear program and running interference for them at the UN. So when you talk about who they're friends with and who they're not friends with, it's a pretty mixed bag. And in some cases, it's a pretty ugly bag. So on to the bad martini today, Jim. And this it comes to us courtesy of your analysis at the Morning Jolt after reading a column from Melinda Henneberger in USA Today. Basically, it focuses on the case of Dylann Roof. For those who don't remember Dylann Roof, he is the guy who in 2015 shot up the African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, killing all but one person. During the trial, he represented himself. It's clear that he did it. It's clear that he doesn't regret it. That enough during the sentencing phase should be enough to warrant an execution, particularly since he was deemed competent to stand trial. But that's not good enough for Melinda Henneberger and others. As you point out in the Jolt, she writes things like, questions raised by the case touch on a tangle of intractable issues: race and rage, guns and mental illness, what constitutes terrorism, and what we can do about self-radicalization on the internet. Yet the racism that Roof spewed seems to have eclipsed all other considerations. As a result, many who generally agree with me that capital punishment is in all cases wrong are silent now. She also is upset that jurors won't even have to try and sort out where free will ends and compulsion begins. The judge in the case kept them from hearing the evidence of mental illness, and they will never hear it now because Roof intends to represent himself during the punishment phase of the trial. And then you also point out that Kathleen Parker is going into Roof's difficult childhood and explaining why he probably should not be put to death. Jim, I like your follow-up sentence to that. I don't care.
Yeah, you can think of me as Tommy Lee Jones in The Fugitive at that moment. Look, there are certain people I have great respect for who have a blanket opposition to the death penalty in all cases and circumstances. Certainly great Catholic thinkers, folks who very much believe the state should never be involved in taking anybody's life. I respect these people. I just see the world pretty distinctly differently that way, because that means you end up in a circumstance where, well, we really shouldn't execute Osama bin Laden. We really shouldn't execute Timothy McVeigh. We really shouldn't execute, if you could go back, the old saying, if you could go back in time, never mind killing Hitler as a child. If we had somehow captured Hitler, that it would be morally wrong to kill him. And my complicated, nuanced, sophisticated response to that, Greg, is nope. No, it's perfectly fine. Perfectly fine to kill somebody like that. I don't see that. Now, but I really get irked when people say, well, that makes us no better than them. No. Executing someone who has killed lots and lots of people is not the same of doing what any of these people did, whether it's parking a truck bomb next to a daycare center like McVeigh, or the horrors of bin Laden, Tsarnaev, who put his bomb next to a child at the Boston Marathon bombing. Or in the case of Roof, I mean, you know, he walked around executing each one of these people one by one. And this whole, I really don't like this idea of, oh, well, he might be crazy. Well, wait a second. He went around saying, I'm going to give you something to pray about. You all want something to pray about? I'll give you something to pray about. You know, Greg, that certainly seems like he understands the consequences of his actions, right? And the whole idea of the insanity plea and the idea that you're not mentally cognizant is, well, you didn't know that pulling the trigger is going to kill somebody. But in this case, I think it's pretty clear that he did, and he did it deliberately. He killed an 87-year-old church choir member. There was a 5-year-old girl in the church Bible study room at that time. You know, if that doesn't get you the electric chair, I don't know what does. And so and there are some people that say, no, that nothing does. There's nothing you can do to make the execution justified. And I just don't see it. But I really don't like this. Mark Helgenberger and all these other folks are trying to drag, oh, why? What was going on inside his head? It's so complicated. I don't care what was going on inside his head. I don't care if he's like the son of Sam and he thinks his dog is telling him to do it. I don't care if he's doing it because he's racist. I don't care if he's doing it because he's got anger. The end result is the same. And so to me, the argument of the death penalty, whether you want to say it's a deterrent or just punishment, look, if you kill lots of people, we as a system of laws will execute you. And my closing point in the Jolt here is that, look, you know, God forbid, none of our listeners ever get murdered. You know, thankfully, it's relatively rare, all things considered. But we all live with that terrible fear. There's a reason that serial killer movies and movies about murder are popular. This is one of the things we live in fear of, and hopefully we can minimize that fear. But unfortunately, none of us can live a life completely free from the risk of being murdered. However, there is a group of people who are constantly under supervision and who basically, unless there's some sort of unexpected bit of prison violence, who live knowing they will never be murdered. Ironically, that group is convicted killers. And to me, that's entirely backwards of the way the world ought to be. The innocent should be protected, and the people who have committed heinous crimes are the ones who should be facing death. So that's where I see it. I thankfully, it looks like this is a very relatively small perspective, but you want to talk, maybe a good segue to our next martini. I find in media circles, blanket opposition to the death penalty in all cases is pretty common. I'd say more than half of the people you could qualify as the elites oppose the death penalty in all cases. As we all know from polling, it's a significant majority of Americans support the death penalty, particularly in cases like that. And one of the things I find really interesting is I like to point back to the polling numbers on Timothy McVeigh back in 2001. More than half of all self-identified death penalty opponents said they wanted to see Timothy McVeigh die. You know, I think people have a nuanced position on these sorts of things. I used to think it was hypocrisy, and now I kind of come around to it. It's like, okay, there are certain crimes we just find so terrible, we accept the death penalty in that case. And so for the folks who I don't think there's any point in muddying the waters about Dylann Roof and his psychology. In the end, he made the decision to kill these people, and he has to pay the ultimate price.
Wow. All right, let's move on to a similar topic, more lighthearted one, I think. Certainly less gravity involved, but it's still quite telling. Earlier this week, a guy named John Ekdahl, who some folks know from founding Decision Desk HQ, that's connected to Ace of Spades. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, don't worry about it. It's not critical to this particular conversation. But we're going to quote your colleague at National Review, Kevin Williamson, here. John Ekdahl set off an amusing storm on Twitter by noting that the three best-selling vehicles in the United States are pickup trucks and asking journalists the seemingly anodyne question of whether they personally know anybody who owns one. The responses were predictable. The sort of smug progressives who are proud of their smugness scoffed at pickups, pollution-belching penis supplements for toothless red state bubbas are found mainly in the sort of communities where they'd never deign to set foot. The sort of smug progressive who are ashamed of their smugness protested that it's a silly question, which it is, that's part of the point, and made strained connections with pickup-owning childhood friends. Back home, conservatives mainly said, har har, stupid liberal elites. And he goes on to say it's actually probably a little bit of blame in both directions here, because we tend to stay connected to people who are already like us. So, Jim, it is an interesting question. It's kind of one that's designed to get kind of a response and a rise out of people who he asked the question to. But the immediate smugness and offensiveness is telling.
Yeah, well, this way, I myself, I think off the top of my head, I haven't completed the full automated survey of all of my friends. I think I only know one person who owns a pickup truck. And so as a result of that, I'm on the lower end of that. But I, to me, the more interesting measuring stick, besides the instinctive, you know, how dare you ask this question, the furious reaction that Ekdahl's question got. And you know, people really flipping out at the implication that they live in a cultural bubble because they don't know someone who drives a pickup truck. To me, it's not not having a friend who owns a pickup truck. The bigger question is, do you have curiosity about this demographic, or do you just kind of dismiss them as flyover country in the red states and oh, these ignorant hicks and something like that? The heart of journalism is curiosity, right? No one has universal life experience. No one has an experience of your life, which is, you know, going to encompass every aspect of American life or societal life. And to kind of preview a piece that I'm working on this for National Review Online, every listener to this podcast is a minority in unexpected ways. For example, Greg, I looked this up. More than half of Americans have not traveled on an airplane in the past year. 55%. Mm. So if you travel on an airplane in the past year, you're in the minority. If you have more than $1,000 in your savings account, you are in a very small minority. More about 70% of Americans have less than $100,000. Wow. 34% of Americans have no savings at all. All right. So for perspective, if you live the life of a white-collar professional, you are very much in that. Now, this doesn't mean you're automatically wrong about everything. It doesn't mean that your opinion's less valid. It just means when you're looking at the country as a whole, you should recognize there are a lot of people who have completely different life experiences from you. And the result of that, their perspective is going to be different. This may or may not be relevant to every, topic that comes down the pike. But for example, gun ownership and gun rights and the Second Amendment. Even if you feel safe and you feel like when you dial 911, the cops are going to be there fast and you don't feel you need a gun. Okay, great. Good for you. But the reason the Second Amendment is there is for the guy who's working the midnight shift at 7-Eleven, where they've had 3 robberies in the past 2 months, right? I mean, ultimately, to understand some of these big issues, you need empathy. You need an ability to see life through the eyes of somebody else. And that's what I think makes for good journalism. I also think makes for good judgment. And the fact that, when the moment you hear about somebody asking, do you know anybody who owns a pickup truck? And you immediately say, oh, the carbon emissions and they're gun-toting redneck. The moment you have that kind of a reaction, you're just demonstrating you cannot understand the experience of somebody who lives differently than you. And the fascinating thing is that the media is very good about this, about saying, you should understand the experiences of African Americans before judging them as a group. You should understand the experiences of the disabled or senior citizens. We understand and we were capable of empathy towards certain groups, but certain outgroups were not. And obviously Southerners are one of them. Rural people are one of them. Gun owners are one of them. Evangelical Christians or even Christians of all stripes. Sometimes you might even argue military veterans. And it's kind of, this is kind of glaring and obvious. And Ekdahl's question just kind of crystallizes that pretty well. And we'd be better off and we'd be better served by the media if these folks tried to break out of their bubble and understand people who thought differently. Maybe they would change their minds. Maybe they wouldn't. But I think we could, one of the reasons 2016 shook out the way it did is because of this sense of constant condescension from elites who are, I think it's pretty safe to say, not all that much elite in terms of their thinking and judgment and way of seeing the world.
Yeah, and it seems like they, like you said, they still have no interest in understanding the people who came back with the election results that surprised them so much. It's just they're doubling down on their elitism, it seems like. We'll see.
Yeah, we're going to see over the next 2 years an increasing split between the prominent folks on the left whose job is to win votes. Both the office holders and the campaign strategists and the folks who want to build a winning strategy and philosophy and rhetoric and message and coalition to get back to being a majority versus those who just really get deep satisfaction out of their sense of cultural superiority and kind of just, that ultimately the smugness is at the core of their identity. And if you take that away from them, it's, deeply psychologically disturbing. Happy Thursday, everybody.
Yeah, really uplifting day today, the 3 Martini Lunch.
Jim, you know what makes you feel better? Just buy a pickup truck.
That's right. See you tomorrow.
We're sponsored today. We should have done, by the Ford F-150 or something like that.
Yeah, that would have been a perfect day for them to advertise. Missed opportunity, guys. Next time. All right, Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to join us on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.